Would you like to turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 10? In the course of time, the king of the Ammonites died and his son Hanun succeeded him as king. David thought, I will show kindness to Hanun, son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent a delegation to express his sympathy to Hanun concerning his father. When David's men came to the land of the Ammonites, the Ammonite nobles said to their lord, Do you think David is honouring your father by sending men to you to express sympathy? Hasn't David sent them to you to explore the city and spy it out and overthrow it? So Hanun seized David's men, shaved off half of each man's beard, cut off their garments in the middle at the buttocks and sent them away. When David was told about this, he sent messengers to meet the men, for they were greatly humiliated. The king said, Stay at Jericho till your beards have grown and then come back. When the Ammonites realized that they had become a stench in David's nostrils, they hired 20,000 Aramean foot soldiers from Beth Rehob and Zobah, as well as the king of Maacah, with 1,000 men and also 12,000 from Tob. On hearing this, David sent Joab out with the entire army of fighting men. The Ammonites came out and drew up in battle formation at the entrance to their city gate, while the Arameans of Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. Job saw that there were battle lines in front of him and behind him, so he selected some of the best troops in Israel and deployed them against the Arameans. He put the rest of the men under the command of Abishai, his brother, and deployed them against the Ammonites. Joab said, If the Arameans are too strong for me, then you are to come to my rescue. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will come to rescue you. Be strong and let us fight bravely for our people and for the cities of our God. The Lord will do what is good in his sight. Then Joab and the troops with him advanced to fight the Arameans, and they fled before him. When the Ammonites saw that the Arameans were fleeing, they fled before Abishai and went inside the city. So Joab returned from fighting the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem. After the Arameans saw that they had been routed by Israel, they regrouped. Hadadezer had Arameans brought from beyond the river. They went to Helam with Shobach, the commander of Hadadezer's army, leading them. When David was told this, he gathered all Israel, crossed the Jordan, and went to Helam. The Arameans formed their battle lines to meet David and fought against him. But they fled before Israel, and David killed 700 of their charioteers and 40,000 of their foot soldiers. He also struck down Shobach, the commander of the army, he died there. When all the kings who were vassals of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with the Israelites and became subject to them. So the Arameans were afraid to help the Ammonites anymore, and you probably wouldn't blame them for being afraid, would you? So we have here wedged in between the story of Mephibosheth and his restoration, which undoubtedly you must have dealt with last time, and then the following chapter, which begins, of course, the, shall I say, decline in David's reign, because we have the twin sins there of adultery and murder, and then, of course, the tremendous consequences of family problems and so on that dogged David over the next chapters of the book of 2 Samuel. But this event, or number of events here in the 10th chapter, are wedged in between the two. And I haven't got any kind of sermon or whatever here tonight. I just want to take us through this chapter a bit and ask you some questions. So be prepared to talk, folks, because I'm not going to do it all. Let me just mention a little bit about the outline of the story. I think you've got the gist of it, haven't you? That David thought, these people have lost their king and there's a new king in his place. I'm going to send some greetings. Now, it could be that there had been in the past some kind of treaty signed between the two countries of Ammon and of Israel. We don't know that for sure, but there's a possibility of it. And that may have been the reason why David thought, okay, we've got this bit of a peace treaty between us, an alliance of a sort, and it would be a good thing for me to bring my greetings and my sympathies and so on to the new king. Now, of course, you read how that the king was persuaded that maybe the motive of David's men or motive of David was wrong, and that they were just going to spy the land out and turn against them and so on. So they humiliated these men by cutting off half their beards. So there they were with whiskers on one side and none on the other. And, of course, in that time, it was really a sign of great grief and sorrow if you were to do that to your face. I mean, a beard was an essential, and to mutilate the beard was almost like mutilating your face. So there was a lot of grief attached to it. But then when they cut their clothes off at the hips, that was really the sign of a prisoner of war. That's really what it meant. It was signifying that these people were being treated like prisoners, but they didn't actually imprison them. They sent them off only half clad, so you can imagine they weren't feeling too happy about it. Don't think any of us would either, would we? So we reread how that this of course provoked David's spirit, and so out went Joab and Abishai, his brother, who was the third brother, by the way, in David's army. Joab, Abishai, and Zeruiah was, in fact, the... Tell me. Anybody know? No? The mother. Zeruiah was the mother of Joab, Abishai, and who was the third one? The hero in the army. Only he got killed by Abner a bit later on in this. No, Abner was the one who killed him, yes. Asa, yeah, you get there. Asahel was his name. So they were the three heroes mentioned among, of course, the listing of David's heroes. Zeruiah was whom? Well, I said the mother of the three, but any other significance? Not sure who Zeruiah was. David's older sister. David's sister. So the three in the army were, in fact, David's nephews. They were working for Uncle David. So we saw what happened there. Seemed like the Ammonites kept to their city, Rabbah, the capital city, and the people that they had coerced to come and help them. The Arameans or Syrians, I suppose, roughly we would call them, wouldn't we? I mean, beyond the river Euphrates, who else were Arameans in the Old Testament of significance? What did they call Laban? You know, where Jacob went, they were Arameans. And there's one suggestion in the Old Testament about Jacob himself, they said, an Aramean ready to perish, they called him. And there is that vital connection with the people of God, with Israel. So they didn't come immediately to fight David's army. What they did was to stay, in a sense, to one side, so that it was going to be a trap, like the pincer effect. Yes, that's right. There would be the Ammonites on one side, but when they found themselves perhaps in trouble, the Arameans would come and attack, in a sense, almost from behind, or at least from a flank, against the armies of Joab. But Joab had his plan, and he was saying to his men, look, I'll fight them, you fight them, and whichever one of us looks like we're in a bit of trouble, we'll have the other come and help us and get us out of this. But they had a great win, as you know, and then the Arameans thought, we don't like this, we'll get a few more people. So they had a recruiting program and came at it again, and this time David went out. You notice that? Wasn't the first time David didn't. Joab did. The second time David went out, that's in 17, verse 17, he gathered all Israel, crossed the Jordan and went to Helam, and there was a tremendous fight, and they fled before Israel, but as we saw there were quite a lot of people killed. What we'd have to say here, of course, is that In the account in Chronicles, it does say 7,000 charioteers, not 700. And it might have been a bit nearer the mark, I don't know. But sometimes there are these copyist errors that occur in the Old Testament where things like a zero adds on or falls off sometimes with the numbers. That happens in a number of places. And that, of course, is due to transmission that happens over period of time, and sometimes numbers get a little bit furry about it. But I don't know about you, when I come to these figures in the Old Testament and I think about 40,000 foot soldiers that have been slain, I don't like to dwell on the gruesomeness of it, but I do feel, a sense of shock and an inability really to take it in. As I think to myself, that's a tremendous number of people to die in a battle. I mean, you think of the battles that occurred in, shall I say, more recent or more modern history, battles like the Gettysburg Day, where I think it was 11,000 or something men that were slain on the paddocks of Gettysburg. Was it something like that? Does anybody remember? Yeah, and then there have been some massacres and so on in the Vietnam War, and then of course we've just not long ago remembered Gallipoli, where thousands and thousands of men died. But the scene that sort of conjured in your mind is one of an awfully gruesome and bloodthirsty and horrifying picture, isn't it? I mean, there's no get away from it. There's no way in the world in which we can look at figures like that and think of the way in which they actually killed each other and imagine that it's not horrible. I mean, it's all very well when we're in our nice clothes, sitting in clean seats, and we haven't got any threat from any enemy anywhere, and we've never ever taken a sword and thrust it into anybody's belly, have we? I don't think there's anybody here that's ever done that. You might have felt like it, but you never have. I mean, we're so removed from this violence, aren't we? And yet we read it so often in the Old Testament. I mean, just to give you a little bit of a reminder of this. If you were to recall what you read in chapter 8, there was a tremendous amount of slaughter there too. I've just listed the number of people. We don't know how many Moabites were killed on this occasion in chapter 8. You know, in verse 2 it says David also defeated the Moabites and so on. He made them lie down on the ground and measured them off with a length of cord and all that sort of thing. But then just a little further on, David captured 1,000 of the chariots of this Hadadezer, and 20,000 foot soldiers, and then of course there were 7,000, it goes on further. Oh, that's right, 22,000 of them in verse 5. And then you probably remember going further down the chapter in verse 13, it says that David became famous after he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. And the Lord gave David victory wherever he went, it says in verse 14. Now, when you think of the career of David, there must have been just a huge number of people that were killed in David's forays and his various attacks and defences and his fighting all around. A huge number of people. I mean, we don't have any figures of the Philistines that were killed in David's reign. Must have been quite a lot of them too. I'm just wanting to come to the point of asking the question, how do we square all this death and bloodshed with love of God? God so loved the world. Did he only begin to do that later on in history? Or did he always do that? God so loved the world. Well, don't expect me tonight to be able to bring you some wonderful, magical answer that's just going to solve all the questions, because I've got questions and not a great number of answers. I simply trust the Lord and I know the Lord's goodness. But I'd just like to ask that question. How do we square it with God of love? And we'll deal with that one first. Perhaps I'll just drop in a few thoughts because, you know, you may not be forthcoming all that quickly. I think there are probably three main reasons why Israel fought a lot of battles. One is they were the people of God and they were attacked, weren't they? I mean, you think of how long it was after they got out of the land of Egypt before they were attacked. You know, Amalekites were after them. And then it wasn't long before Balak was getting Balaam to come and curse them and so on. See, the people of God were a target because the evil one hates the people of God. He hates us, actually. But he hates Israel, always has. And if a nation is attacked, then they must fight to defend themselves. I mean, we need to convince a few people right now about that in Israel, don't we? I mean, the prejudice that there is against Israel in the press across the world, where, a huge percentage of those who report these things and write their stories are all siding with the Palestinians as though the great villains of the Middle East are the Jews. And so much of their information is twisted and wrong, distorted, misinformation. And they fail to recognise that the current land or nation of Israel is not a nation looking for war. They're looking for peace. And they have to defend themselves. They don't do everything right. Neither did they do everything right in David's day. But they had to defend themselves. So the first thing is, I believe, that if you're going to be attacked, you're going to have to defend yourself. And you will defend yourself under the rule, the sovereign rule and guidance of God, expecting Him to give you success. Otherwise, you know, the nation would be wiped out, wouldn't it? If the devil had his way, he would have wiped Israel out more than once in history. The second thing is, I believe that God used Israel as an instrument of judgment. And this isn't just an opinion, is it? I mean, it's there in the Word that God judged the Canaanites, didn't he, and the various other ites that existed around that period when the land was taken by the invading forces of Joshua. They were invaders. And they were killing the people, genocide if you like, and they were going to take their land. Now, it was all revolting to the modern mind. And the non-Christian person of today, of course, will just condemn outright any of these sorts of actions as being barbarous, uncivilized. These people were nothing but tribal savages that were just exerting their will upon other people, stealing their land and stealing everything from them and so on. And they would put it into that kind of category. But we who know the Bible and know our God also know that God judges people, and that in the Old Testament dispensation that there was, shall I say, a temporal judgment that we don't necessarily see in the age in which we live. I mean, God doesn't, it appears, in our day, judge people on a wholesale basis because of their sin. I mean, you hear people talking about that when there's a tsunami or something like that. And look, as I say, I haven't got all the answers. I don't know whether I can, you know, come down heavily on one side or the other of the argument. But I do know this, that in the kind of calamities that we see today in our world, it's not just bad people that are on the receiving end of it. There are all kinds of what we might term innocent people and Christian people who are mixed up in all of the tragedy of earthquakes and goodness knows what else in the way of natural catastrophes and whatever. You know, there's a drought or there's a flood or whatever, and it's very often indiscriminate. Well, from our point of view, I'm not saying it's indiscriminate from God's, but from our point of view, we can't say God did that to those people because they deserved it. We can't say that. But I am saying this, that in the day of David, it is very clear from Scripture that God was using Israel as an instrument of judgment against sin and idolatry. And I have a feeling that if you or I knew what it was to see people slain like this, and we saw the bloodshed and we saw the death, surely it would make us say, God hates idolatry, we ought to keep well away from it. And I believe God was teaching them what he thought of idolatry. He's saying, this is my estimate. This is how much I hate idolatry. And yet, of course, we know the people of God, Israel, still were enticed, weren't they? And they still went down the wrong track, despite the very vivid, powerful lessons that God was teaching them through warfare. The third possibility is this, that there were times when maybe David, maybe some others, did act impulsively or did act vengefully. I mean, we can't possibly say that everything they did was without sin. I mean, the record shows that they were sinners. And the record shows that David was fallible. He wasn't an infallible man. And I wonder sometimes whether perhaps they didn't go over the top in their killing and in their rampaging and in their tearing down of cities or villages. Now, where it tells us that God was with them and doing it, then, of course, the case is closed. We know that it's of God. But I just mentioned that as a third possibility. Anybody got any comments? What's your reaction? I mean, you've been thinking about this over the years. You must have. Every time you've read the Old Testament, the thoughts have come to you, hey, why has this happened? Yeah, as I mentioned, in the Old Testament, the dispensation was one wherein it was do this or die, in a sense, wasn't it? You know, we live in an age of grace. I'm wanting to come to that a little bit later. But just to show that in the Old Testament, it was works that condemned the unbeliever, and God's judgment fell on them in a, as I mentioned, in a temporal way. In other words, in time they felt the anger and the judgment of God. That doesn't happen now, I don't believe. I mean, it might in some mysterious way, but in the Old Testament it wasn't really mysterious when thousands like this were wiped out. It was very, very plain and obvious that this is the hand of God. I was going to also point out a verse in chapter 8, again, talking about God being with the people. It's verse 15 there in chapter 8, where it's David reigned over all Israel. Now, notice this, doing what was just and right for his people. Now, you've just read in the chapter 8 about the huge battles and about the killing of the Edomites and so on. And then it says, David reigned over Israel doing what was just and right for his people. This is the word of God. Yeah. All right. Well, okay, we've seen that part of it. How come this man David, whose sword was dripping with blood, and was in fact prevented from building the temple for that very reason, because he was a man of blood. And then, as we are going to see in 11 and 12, he committed adultery and murder, and it was just horrible what he did. It certainly wasn't just and right in the eyes of God. And yet he's described as a man after God's own heart. I want you to notice too that this expression that is so often used, man after God's own heart, was used in two places in the Bible. The first one is when Saul was being rejected as king. So you go back to 1 Samuel and you'll find that there in the 13th chapter, the 14th verse, Samuel says to Saul that he's rejected as king because of what Saul did in presuming to offer sacrifice when he shouldn't have done that at all. And Samuel said that God has a man after his own heart who's going to be anointed king in your place. So the expression was used before David was even king. And at that point, He certainly was a man after God's own heart, wasn't he? If anybody wanted to be contentious about the issue, we would say, okay, there he was, the young man, grew up and killed Goliath and whatever, but he didn't put a foot out of place, really, did he? I mean, it says he behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and nobody could criticise David. And that was the reason why Saul was so jealous and hateful, because Saul just simply couldn't stand having a young man like this around the place that people admired so much. So he certainly was a man after God's own heart. And the other place in which it's used by the Apostle Paul. That's the only other place you'll see the expression, a man after God's own heart. And that's in the 13th chapter of the book of Acts. And you remember this is the first missionary journey, and Paul is at Antioch, and he gives that great sermon in the 13th chapter. And in the middle of that, when he's rehearsing some of the history of Israel, he speaks about David and says he's a man after God's own heart. So that's how all of that took place. But I just like to think of him as a godly man, and yet a man who was prone to mistakes, and who was looking forward. I believe he was looking forward, wasn't he, to "I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." And when people want to kind of point the finger to David, but as they'll do when you read the 11th and 12th chapters of this book, we've got to remember, hey, we are just made of the same flesh, and there's no way in which we can point the finger and say, "You wretched, low down skunk," or whatever we might like to call him, because look, the potential for sin is just in us, isn't it? That's our nature, and we too must, as David did, look forward to being in his presence, in the Lord's presence, and free from this wretched sin that dogs our footsteps. All right, I want to now just say something more about the character of David, and you can think of some of these things too, before we come to, shall I say, a bottom line for tonight. But interesting what George says here about the New Testament. I've heard people say, you know, in the Old Testament you get the gruesome, harsh realities. In the New Testament it's all love and grace, as if God the Father is very severe and merciless, but the Son, the Lord Jesus, he's the one who is tender and gracious. Now, that's a totally misconceived picture of reality. I've often said this: the most severe, shocking and frightening words in the Bible fell from the lips of the Lord Jesus. Think of them. When he said, "For their worm dieth not, and the fire shall never be quenched." Oh, that's terrible. I mean, the battlefields of the Old Testament, as I said, temporal judgment, it comes and it goes. Lives are expended. Bodies are buried. Lives are ended. But in hell, there is no ending. Their worm dies not. The fire shall never be quenched. But then I look further on into the book of Revelation, and I believe that so much of that judgment that is poured out upon this earth is literal. I mean, so many people want to try and put a great spiritual spin on it, and so many people want to throw it back into history as though it's already happened and so on. I'm sorry, but I can't see it that way. I believe the days ahead for this world are pretty grim, especially for those who don't believe. Grim days ahead. And the judgments of the book of Revelation would make your hair stand on end and put a chill up your spine. So while I am saying there's a difference between Old Testament times and New Testament times, and there is a difference, especially when we're speaking about the rule of God and the approach that we have spiritually to God, there is a difference, and we'll come to that in a minute. But as far as the severity, shall I say, of God is concerned, there is no change. You remember Paul spoke about the goodness and the severity of God, and he spoke about it in one breath. And the world that we live in today can't take it. They cannot stand it because they think severity means goodness is cancelled, or if you're good, you're never severe. And they don't understand the nature of God. That's why they can't even bring their kids up, because they think if they're loving, they're never going to be firm or severe. And they think if they're severe, well, they couldn't possibly be loving. And that's why people are messing up with bringing up their kids today. God is both goodness and severity. He exercises them, and he will. He'll continue to do so. But, okay, I just want to put that a little bit to one side as we pursue with David, and just to take up what George is saying too about the character of David. I've always been amazed at this, that on the one hand, David could lead his army out, and he could fight to the very bitter end. I mean, there must have been times when they had hardly a breath left in their body and they were pursuing enemies. I mean, you think of the time he came to Ziklag, found that his wives and children and all were gone and the place was burned and he was broken. But off he went again. Led his men. Found the camp of all the Amalekites and whoever they were that pinched his goods and his families, and then he fought them and cleaned them up. There must have been huge determination on his part. He must have been a mighty, persistent fighter. But let's look at another side to him. Second Samuel. Did I say Second Samuel there? Chapter 15. Yeah, okay. 2 Samuel chapter 15. What am I looking at here? Yeah, you remember the rebellion of his son, Absalom, of a terrible story, really. And yet, you remember how, despite the rebellion of Absalom and Absalom's willingness to even kill his own father, I mean, he was really at a very low point with that man. Yeah, that's what I'm coming to. And when the news came, of course, that his son had been killed, we find there that David is just crying out to God in his pain of his what a funny thing, this particular Bible of mine's got a page missing. Would you believe it? Yeah, I don't always use this one. I just picked this one up tonight, but it's not the one I use. But anyway, there it is. Isn't that interesting? I've got a whole page of my Bible. It just goes bang straight into chapter 16. But you remember how David wept. And look, this, you see here, a soft-hearted man. He didn't say, well, good riddance to that rebellious son of mine. Nothing like that. Broken-hearted man. He said, would God that I had died for you. Absalom, my son. But then it cast my mind also back to the time of Saul's death and Jonathan's death. And you remember the bow, the poem. And here's the heart of a man who, instead of saying, oh boy, we've got Saul off our hands now, good riddance to him, what a pest he's been, he's chased me for the last 10 years, which is fact. Saul chased David for 10 years. And yet, here are his words. Yes, Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and gracious, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, brother Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love was more wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. How the mighty fall and the weapons of war have perished. See again, the heart of a very sensitive man. Not a barbarian, a very sensitive man. Think about the messenger that came. There's a messenger came and said to David, hey, you know, I've got some signs here to show that the king's dead, you know. And David thought about that after a while, and he thought, you've come to me to tell me that God's anointed has been slain on the mountains of Gilboa, and you actually caused his death. Well, it sounded that way, because the man was pitching the story that way, I suppose, to gain a bit of favour with David. And David said, no, you haven't brought me good news at all. And he told his men to execute him. It wasn't the only time he did that either. You remember after this, there was a rebellion in the land, in that Ish-bosheth was put on the throne, and Abner was propping up Ish-bosheth and so on. And Abner came and made a truce with David, and then on his way home, Joab came back from a fight, found out from David that Abner had been there and that there had been a truce made, and Joab was angry about this because this man Abner had killed his brother Asahel, his younger brother. So he went off after him, or sent messengers after him, and said, the king wants to see you again. So they deceived Abner into coming back into the town, and who was waiting for him at the city gate? By the way, this was a city of refuge, city of Hebron. But Joab was there with his stiletto, and he was ready just to pull it out at the right moment. He said to Abner, oh, look, I've got a little secret I want to tell you. Whisper in your ear. And he gave it to him under the third or the fifth rib or something. And Abner was slain. Now, you could say about David, oh, well, look, this rival king up in Mahanaim there, this Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, we've got rid of him, and now I'll be king over the whole country, and no more problems from them. But instead of that, we find that he called his people to mourn, and he wept over the death of Abner, and he wept at the graveside and said, died Abner as a fool dies, and so on. And yet he was a brave warrior, and yet he had this awful death. So again, David didn't rejoice in the fact that Abner had been massacred or assassinated. No way. Because, as I say, he had more depth and more sincerity and more sensitivity in his character than to do otherwise. And then I think about this chapter that you, or Ish-bosheth's death too, when someone killed, or two blokes killed Ish-bosheth, they came and they wanted to, you know, share the news with David, and he said, you've killed an innocent man on his bed, and so he had them executed for doing it. And then we think about Mephibosheth. Here he is, a grandson of King Saul. Again, the man who made David his enemy. And instead of banishing Mephibosheth and saying, oh, you know, you're one of the previous dynasty and we don't like you, get out of here, you saw what happened in chapter 9. Come and live with me. Put your feet under my table. A grace that was shown there by David. It's wonderful. Now, we don't do it as they did in the Old Testament with the fear, I'll do this or else. You know, an external observation and so on. We do it quite differently because now, you remember the Sermon on the Mount, there's a tremendous contrast, isn't there, between just the outward behaviour of conforming to, say, the Ten Commandments or whatever, and the other kind of behaviour, which is living from the heart, a spiritual life whereby we walk not after the flesh but after the Spirit, in the power of the Spirit of God. Very, very different and a very wonderful dimension. And that's the demand that we have. I mean, you read the Sermon on the Mount and you see the kind of behaviour that the Lord said, this is the way you ought to live. You ought to have, your righteousness should exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Now, he wasn't saying that in order to be saved, you've got to live like that. But we cannot lower the bar and say, oh no, he really gave us some tremendous commandments there and he didn't really expect us to live up to them. Oh, I didn't know the Lord ever gave us any commandments he didn't expect to live up to. But if we were to examine our own hearts, we'd say, impossible, because in myself I cannot do it. And it's true, isn't it? In myself I can't do it. Paul said that. Romans 7. You can't. But God has provided wonderfully for us, hasn't he? And instead of us thinking that, you know, there's a Goliath out there that we've got to get with five smooth stones or something, there are giants out there, namely unbelief and sin. And they're the biggest ones that you'll ever have in front of you. I mean, in a sense, they are bigger than Satan himself. Our biggest enemies are our unbelief and our sin. And we've got to remember every day we get out of bed in the morning that that's the enemy we're facing. Now, it is also true, as Paul points out, that we are wrestling against, not flesh and blood, we haven't got an army out there that's after us, not at the moment anyway, but we are wrestling against principalities and powers and the rulers of darkness. What a challenge. I mean, they're more fearful than any earthly army because of who they are and the power they have. And that's why we've got Ephesians 6 that tells us to put on the armour of God. We don't have to go out with, you know, pieces of iron on our head and on our breastplate and all the rest of it with a literal sword in our hands, but what we do need every day is that spiritual armour, which of course is described for us there in the 6th chapter of Ephesians. So friends, what a challenge. We're not people who can sit back and just simply say, oh well, I'm saved now, oh, give me an armchair and I'll just relax. No. We are in a battle.